Hello and welcome to another edition of Turn Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, my buddy, my pal, Kurt Vile is on the show from the Violators. He used to be in the War on Drugs, Black Banana, and more on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damian. There's a YouTube page, a TikTok page, an Instagram page, and a Facebook page for this podcast. All can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that we do here twice a week now. I'm trying to get back to doing them twice a week. So, yeah, tell them. I also play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information about us over at fuckedup.cc or on Twitter or Instagram at Fucked Up. We are currently going on tour with Superchunk in the new year, and we will also be putting out new material constantly, so you can find out all about that stuff over at fuckedup.cc. We got new t-shirts too, so, you know, head on over there if you are so inclined. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, Kurt Vile is here from the Violators, from War on Drugs, from Black Bananas. He is a incredible songwriter, one of my favorite songwriters, and an awesome person who I have not spoken to for a very long time up until this podcast. We were on tour together before that, and then we'd run into each other a few times afterwards, but we had not caught up in a long time, so it was great to have an opportunity to sit down and just punish the shit out of him. Something I never really did on tour. And that's why I do this, because there's stuff you find out, even about people that I know, well, you find out, I find out about people I know, they don't tell me beforehand. I'm not going to spoil what Kurt reveals in this one, but you'll hear it in a second. There's some shit we should have been talking about a long time ago. But anyway, you're going to hear it in a second. Kurt has a brand new, well, it's like a monster EP, I guess, but it's called Back to Moon Beach. It is a 6-song record. There's actually like a 10-song version, too. All of that can be found over at KurtVile.com, and you can order that stuff. There's also a CD. I wonder if the CD has all the other tracks on it. I don't know. You can find out for yourself over there, and that is out on Verve Records. Kurt will be going on tour with the Violators in the new year. You can find out dates over at KurtVile.com as well. I think it's all in March, and the dates after that too. So head on over there and find that out, order that EP, or check it out wherever you listen to your music. I think it's available everywhere now. And that is that. All right, sit back, relax, and enjoy Kurt Vile on Turned Out a Punk. Kurt, welcome to the show. I almost said welcome back to the show, because I feel like this should have happened so long ago that this is almost like a part two, but it's a part one. Welcome to the show.
Hey man, thanks. No, it does feel like I'm back. Welcome back to the show, because we go way back.
We do.
At this point.
We do. And I actually, one of my biggest interview regrets ever was the time that I interviewed you on my TV show. And I told you I didn't like Smoke Rings as much as I like Childish Prodigy. And I felt like that's like the biggest dickhead thing to say to someone, and it's always haunted me that I said that to you.
Well, I do take things like that personal sometimes, but you must have said it in a way that, first of all, you're being honest, and I wouldn't expect you necessarily to, but I don't remember that at all. So I think you got a pat. Like, I respect it. The way you said it, I must have respected it. But that's sweet that you. But yeah, you got to be honest sometimes, you know, it depends. But that was a transition record for me. And I'm so proud of Childish Prodigy. And I'm proud that it was underrated, I guess. Mm-hmm. But then that, you know, it was Kim Gordon's favorite record. And Bradford Cox, and you invited me on tour because of it. You know, I got booed in your hometown because of it, you know, and I'm proud of that. I think so, whatever.
I feel like that was the thing I was trying to convey to you at the time, is that, like, I think that Childish Prodigy, I think, was just like, that's one of my favorite records, definitely of that year. And I remember just being, having such a tight relationship to it. And, you know, and I thought Smoke Rings was going to be way bigger. I knew right away that this thing is going to be the one that's going to be like the launching pad for the, for you as this like great songwriter. But it's just only as you get a little older and in it a little longer, you realize like sometimes you just don't need to say shit. Like sometimes you can just leave your opinion unsaid, especially when someone's like on the first steps on that journey.
Wow. Yeah. I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah. Cause I don't remember. And and believe me, I don't forget either. So the way you said it, I must have respected it because I don't remember at all.
Well, now that we've gotten that out of the way, Kurt, welcome to the show. And I got to start it off the way they all should start off, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Man, for me, it's not so cut and dry because – shoot, man, like, for instance, you know, before I knew any better, I would think that punk is like NOFX, you know. I was into NOFX and like some of that Epitaph stuff for a minute, but like Operation Ivy, yeah, that's not Epitaph, but like, you know, Rancid, you know, there was all that crossover new school punk. I mean, I feel like maybe I might like Rancid now. I think I might like them again.
Oh my gosh, they got some songs. They got like, those guys could write. They did all three of those records back to back to back to back, and all of them have cuts on them.
Yeah, but like, and I haven't heard them really since then. I still hear the song I Want to Riot in my head now. I haven't heard it maybe for a while, but I often, just for no reason lately, say, give them the boot, the Roots are radical, you know? But that's new school punk, you know? Let's keep that separate.
That's part of it, though. That connects right back to the beginning, right? Like, that's what I love about it is that, and I will probably talk about it in a second, but that fingers cut Mega Machine band is the dude from Oscar, right? An Epitaph band. So you got deep connections to Epitaph, too.
Well, maybe they're on Epitaph now, but yeah, there's a kid that went to Dartmouth with my wife, Suzanne, who put that 7-inch out. He would put out this punk music, and my music didn't really fit on that, but yeah, that was my first split 7-inch. I like to think that I... Like, for instance, there's a club. Even when I was in high school, I would go to West Philly into the ghetto, and there was a known punk house called Stalag 13, and I would play my banjo there. And there are bands like Dis Sucks. They were cool back then. Was a Philly band. I don't even know if you ever heard of them. But there's all kinds of crusty punk bands playing there, and I played there, you know. I wasn't punk, and that's kind of a good analogy of how I got into quote-unquote punk. You know, like, I love the Ramones more than anything. I love Suicide. I got into those bands in my 20s, you know. And I grew up in my teens on, Pavement, you could say, is a gateway drug. Pavement obviously have punk influence. They have punk in them. You listen to Slanted and Enchanted as punk, and then you get their gateway drug is like, oh, this Hey Drag City, you know, compilation has Pavement on it, and then you hear all those weird bands, and then my life kind of changed. Like, that's sort of my punk, is like more edgy, arty thing. But there are so many punk bands that I love that I got religious about. We worship the Ramones. Like I said, I worship. You know, Suicide's a proto punk band, and then they got into, you know, they're like more they've always been punk, but like it's more like it could also be like disco in another way, you know. So when's the first time I heard punk? I have no clue, you know. I like the Dead Milk Band, they're not really a punk band, but I heard them. They're from Philly, and that's where I come from.
I would say 100% Dead Milkmen are a punk band. I think Pavement are a punk band. I think that's the thing, is like at one time it's a snowboard kid at the mall wearing a NoFX t-shirt. At the same time, it's also like Dinosaur Jr. and someone like getting in. Dinosaur Jr. was my gateway to punk. I feel like we let it get codified by other people, but like, here, the fact is, the first place that I heard about you on was the fact that you did a CD on Gulture Records, and the Gizmos invented punk.
Right. No, through my buddy Richie Charles, who used to drum in Clock Cleaner, and he has a record label called Richie Records and Testoster Tunes. He got me, I was working at a brewery, and he got me onto Gulture, which, and my collection of, like a best of my CDRs, a best of which hardly anybody had heard, except for people in my tiny orbit heard those songs. And I had enough CDRs of my own material that I got Gulture Records to put it out. That was when I already had all but He's All Right and the outro track on Childish Prodigy in the bag. The reason I gave Gulture that collection was because I was holding Childish Prodigy for my big break, you know, for a label. And I turned down a few labels before Matador agreed. In fact, we sent Childish Prodigy to Matador twice. When I say we, I mean my manager, Rennie. He's like, let's just play dumb and send it to him again, you know? So I'm pretty proud of that. But so, yeah, so to be on a label, you know, we both were on Matador. You're not on Matador anymore. Neither am I. But we both were on the label that started Pavement and so many. Yeah. So I grew up on Pavement, Dinosaur Jr. for sure. Sonic Youth. You know, the first punk record I might've heard aside from indie rock adjacent, you know, White Light, White Heat. That's the first punk record maybe that I ever really heard, you know, that's my teens. I love that they're all connected. You know, you're right.
Were your like older siblings or your parents into the Velvet Underground? Like, how'd you hear about them?
No, I heard of them. I had some older friends into Lou Reed. Eventually they were listening to Velvets too, but I think I heard Lou Reed first. But yeah, somewhere along the way, I was a reader. I was just talking on another podcast, a book podcast about this, but I remember I went to Borders Books, and that's where I would find out everything. I'd go on their computer to find out what Pavement, you know, is on, and then it tells you everything. And then I go to the one small music section. I get Sonic Youth, Confusion is next, the book, Velvet Underground, Uptight. Right around then, right before I graduated, I feel like I was so deep in the Sonic Youth and the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed, and so those are like all at the same time, just, you know, frying my brain with inspiration, you know, because the combination of noise and poetry and, you know, catchy hooky punk rock combined, you know, somewhere, and you know that there's the concoction sort of a teenage mind.
I think that really does start with the Velvet Underground, where you have this sort of like lack of virtuosity being forefronted in the band. And then like you see with the Modern Lovers even more so, where there's like obviously these songs they're brilliant and these people playing them are brilliant, but they're sort of like anyone can do this, and like you can write an incredible song and you don't need Phil Spector production. You can have it kind of just like shine through somehow. Like it just feels like that would have been a Permission record.
Permission?
Yeah, Permission to like just do it yourself, like to just
start. Oh yeah, Permission. No, I love that. And I will say in a way, like my punk, you know, because that's like punk, like, you know, you watch the Essential Ramones documentary End of the Century, and Danny Fields is like, the people came to the shows and they said, what? These people, no future. They saw these guys, they can't play. They could still get paid. They could still get laid. you know, and they these people start a band, or the quote that Eno said that, like, you know, not everybody saw the Velvet Underground, but whoever did started a band. Like, I would say that my version of that was when I got that compilation, the Hey Drag City compilation, and then everybody track on there, some more than others, but they were all kind of jagged, but there were still some, like, the vocals cut through, and it was the bare essentials combined with weirdness, and the Silver Juice track, Famous Eyes, even the opening track, Palace Brothers, for the Me Cons and All. It was just, I don't know if it's like so well recorded, and just that there's no effects on anything, and it just punchy. And there's a song on there called Ike by Fruitcake. It's psychedelic and so melodic and hypnotic, but still it's punk. Or Royal Trucks, you know, Jen Harima, that's a friend of mine. I like to throw that out there all the time. You know, she invented a lot of things, and that's my girl.
She's the best. When she was on the podcast, she said her biggest influence was Discharge, and hearing Discharge and hearing them bury these, like, really catchy pop songs in walls of noise, and how that inspired her. And it was just like, it's like you're saying, it's punk is whatever you define it as. Bill Callahan did, like, old punk zines back in the day. Like, Will Oldham used to know every Misfits song lyric and Ramones song lyric off by heart.
Oh, yeah.
Like, all that Flying Nun stuff. Like, that's punk to me. Like, they took it in their own direction, right?
Yeah. Well, I worship Danzig today, even. And the Misfits, I got into them recently, more recently, you know. Static Age, of course. Like, and just to be clear, though, Discharge, the label?
No, or the band.
The band. Oh, man. See, I meant to say that first. Now I look like an idiot. All right, I'm going to check out Discharge, the band.
No, you will love it. And I like, that's where Dis Sucks got their name. And you're not the first guy to mention them on this podcast, because, like you're saying, Stalag is kind of the Gilman of Philadelphia in a lot of ways. And I think I don't think I had any clue that you played there. And it's so awesome that it was a space that, yeah, like, you know, so many great hardcore bands came through there and played, like Rambo and all this sort of stuff came out of there. But, like, it still was a space that you could go there and play a banjo at and find a stage.
Only me, mind you. I'm the only one that played banjo there. Yeah. Nobody else did.
You're ahead of the folk punk trend by a good, like, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I had a song called Skate Bitch, you know, about, like, skate groupies, you know, skate groupies. Because it was, like, it was all, you know, we would skate, and then there was these other better skaters who would always have a bunch of girls hanging out with them and, you know, drinking 40s and stuff. And we never had that luxury, you know. But, like, that's funny. Did you go to Stalag 13?
Oh, yeah. I went there, and I remember my story that I always tell about there is going to the bathroom, and someone had gone into the stall and taken a shit beside the toilet.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Or people, the bathroom I remember is just out back, which was like a bunch of broken 40s in the backyard, and people piss all over.
Yeah.
You know,
it was a real venue, but it was also, you know, out of these spaces come so many cool people and so many interesting bands. And I think the stuff in Philadelphia has always been fascinating. Like, going back, you brought up the Dead Milkmen. To me, they're a punk band.
Yeah, that rules, man. I know. I'm proud of where I'm from. I'm proud I never left. And yeah, when I was a teen, the first thing we did was, first show we put on a homeless benefit, quote unquote. We got a church to let us put the show on. And a lot of punk bands did come through the Stalag 13 circuit. And we did get Dis Sucks to play. And I still remember, like, that show. I still remember how he looked. And I still remember him being like, "Son walked into my bed again this morning. There's nothing I can do to make it go away." And I only heard him do it that night, that day, whatever the hell it was. Whatever. Are they still around?
No. Oh, Dis Sucks? No, I don't think they're around. Members went on to,
I mean, alive? Are they alive?
I think I definitely, pretty sure most of the members are still alive. On the Tony Pointless episode, we talked a lot about Dis Sucks and kind of their importance to that Philadelphia, I guess, like, squat venue scene. Before, like, the church, right?
Yeah, well, that was during, you know, we got them to come to this church. But yeah, well, Stalag was still going on. I feel like there was one other house in West Philly called something that I've been to, but mainly it was Stalag that I went to.
Yeah, there was another venue like right down the street, I think before or after Stalag. Stalag. If I knew we were going to be talking about this, I would have boned up my research a little better in this kind of area. But yeah, like it's awesome when you think about it, that time period, R5 Productions kind of going and sort of the rise of independent productions, yourself, Diplo. There's a lot of cool, interesting stuff coming out of sort of Philadelphia indie punk adjacent basement shows. In Japanese
Yeah, no.
Breakfast today and stuff.
Oh yeah, I'll have to listen to Japanese Breakfast more. I'm not sh I know people love him, and I met her. She's very, very nice, but I don't actually don't know her music, so that's I didn't know there was punk in it. That's cool.
She used to do the door at R5.
Oh right. I heard that. That's awesome. And that's I do love. I love that this is a show going town, but in the early days, yeah, R5, we just owe them so much in the DIY and this indie rock scene and just independent just the 90s, I guess, into the late 90s and watching it all bud into what it is today. I it's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome, man. Philly in particular.
It always feels like, especially in the early days of punk, having people on here talking about it, like it was sort of the city that kind of was underdocumented and undercelebrated. It had all these great bands, but you know, short of the Dead Milkmen, you don't really YDI isn't celebrated as much as they should be, or FOD is not celebrated as much as they should be. But it feels like because of people's hard work and great record labels that were based in that city, really cool people doing all sorts of different kind of stuff, that Philly in the early 2000s becomes like kind of like the low key kind of hotbed.
Yeah, and I will say I've always kind of been honestly, I've always kind of been on the outskirts, like an outsider, like where I was doing my thing, and I'm trying to get people to be interested for so long. I just wasn't didn't know as many people, so I honestly felt like I was outside of the R5 thing. Really, I just didn't know people, like that's all it really was, and I had inferiority complex. But that said, at the end of the day, I did come out pretty punk because I did come from the outside. I came through Gulcher Records. It's like and got my DIY stuff put out first. And not only that, it was a 14 track song, album of real songs, like weird psychedelic bedroom recordings and one smash hit in the front recorded in the studio, Freeway. What can I say? And then while I was making Childish Prodigy, like still like nobody, that like Hunchback and stuff. I remember my buddy Richie, who I work with, like he was in Clock Cleaner and they did made Babylon Rules, and I was making songs like Hunchback, which definitely punk influence. I was more into punk, I feel like, then in my mid to late 20s. I was getting influenced by more punk bands, and but also again like more like the Swell Maps and things like that, like post-punk. Is that post-punk? Right? Is that
Well,
post-punk? Like
they are post-punk, I
Wire?
guess. Yeah, like I guess it gets called post-punk, but like when you look at the chronological kind of timeline, they're there as punk's happening. Like to me, that is,
Yeah.
you know, first wave punk. And it just
And
It later on it gets reduced and kind of like boxed off into these sort of like subsects of like what is and isn't punk rock. But to me, like, how can you listen to the Gizmos and say that this is anything but, you know, true rebellion music?
yeah. And so yeah, around the time I was recording things like Hunchback, it took a couple years to get anybody interested, So I was doing that. So that was pretty punk in itself, 'cause nobody was, we were playing shows and I was putting out CDRs, but nobody was putting my music out. And around that time, yeah, I got religious about things like the Swell Maps and the Fall and the Dead Sea, just that. So that's kind of where I really got consciously into punk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Before it was, Yeah.
Well, not Dead Sea, like 100%. Like that's, the other side of Flying Nun. Like the fact that there's also, in addition to these, like the greatest, most beautiful indie songs ever written, there's also some of the greatest noise
Yeah.
punk shit happening at the same time, all in like a town of 100,000 people. Like, how fucking crazy is that?
Yeah, Alistair Galbraith. I love that stuff. I love that stuff, like massages my brain, like that's that art. They just do that right style of arty noise over there in beautiful Dunedin or something, in the south of New Zealand, where the South Island, where it's beautiful enough, but they're isolated enough that that's the kind of stuff that's coming out of their guitars and onto their four tracks.
I don't know. It just feels like that's like this sort of their manifestation of punk. And that's what I think is cool about you playing a banjo with bands like these crusty bands at these at the venue like that, because that is finding your own sort of rebellion in the world you're in and finding your own, making your own space in it.
Well, that's cool. I think, I just had a friend who went to those shows, so he brought me in just by chance, but it certainly set it sounds it looks good on paper, now looking back.
No, but I think you did kind of, you then changed the music too, influence on it after the fact, and the fact that you came from it. Like I first heard about you, and I think the first place that I think you started making noise that I was hearing about was kind of like hardcore kid, punk kid, but aging hardcore kid, punk kid blogs, and these sort of places that people were talking about these CDRs that you had coming out, and then of course Gulcher being such a venerable label. And are you aware that you can come in a fine tradition too by also getting popular and more popular with your sound? John Cougar Mellencamp was on Gulcher.
Yeah, I know. Yep. That's my boy.
You met him?
No.
I always
He's in
want to meet him.
Indiana. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny because, yeah, like Life Goes On. I love that song more every year.
Yeah, like you grow into those records. Like I liked them as a kid, and then there was of course like a rejection of that sound for a while. Though Avail covered Pink Houses on a record, so I did love the Avail cover. But coming back to them as a dad now, an aging father, it hits a lot harder in a different way now.
Yeah.
It's amazing how we get to a point in like kind of this trip where no matter what you do, you kind of got to accept the fact that there's like some of these songwriters that there's a reason they're super popular.
Who? Like who?
John Cougar Mellencamp.
Oh yeah.
I was like,
Oh
oh,
yeah.
anyone could do this shit. Now I realize, no, that guy had a talent.
You know what I think it is, part of it is that they, I can't speak for John Cougar Mellencamp because I've never seen him live, but you think you're talking about the Springsteens and the whatever, like they, or even let's jump, it's like a pop artist today or pop artist anytime, they deliver every time. Whereas me, sure, when the band gets oiled up, we sound good, but I can be pretty raw. But like, I can deliver on tape a song. Like, there's like a moment where it's good, and then I feel like I get bored. That's one of my theories. Why they're, because they're on. They gotta be on all the time, not just once.
I feel the opposite, man. I look at you and being like, he's on all the time with all these songs he's putting out. How's he do it?
Oh, damn. Well, thanks you, but I'm putting out songs. And then I'm a lot of them I don't end up playing live ever. I go in and I record it, and then yeah, event, the certain songs make it to live, and then you're playing the same set every night. Ideally, that's how they stay good. But other, in between, there's pretty much no in between. If I play solo, sure, I can whip things out, but it's either you play the same songs every night, or you don't play them at all. Just
Well,
once. I play them once in the studio
yeah.
and I record it,
Yeah.
and that's it.
But you like, on that tour we did, you went there out every night, and like you're saying, sometimes the crowd would be downright hostile towards you. But that's when I knew you. You had like you yeah. had something, because like you were unshakable in a way that, like, when I did the Arcade Fire tour opening and we had kind of the same reaction from the fans, it affected my performance in a way that I never saw it affect. You never let it on that it was affecting you.
Oh wow, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, but in those days I was pretty hardcore. I was living a pretty wild life, you know. And I had my buddy Rob Robinson with me, and he was like, what happened was we had been on the road as the band, and it was our first tour, and I wrote a song about it called On Tour. You know, certain people didn't get along, and we were just trying to, you know, Adam was juggling his War on Drugs bands. Obviously, he was trying to get his record done, and my drummer didn't, you know, like I didn't have it all together. You know, we were on the, just at a certain level. And so anyway, when I went on tour with you, it was going to be, I went and into the snow in the Midwest solo, and my buddy Rob would help me. But when I get to Philly, the band will reconvene and we'll go up to Canada with them. But I borrowed a buddy's guitar, and Delirious in Indiana, home of John Cougar Mellencamp. We went to the Steak and Shake, and it was snow everywhere. And I loaded in the gear, or I thought I did, but what I left was his Martin acoustic guitar in the snow. And let's just say when I woke up, it wasn't anywhere to be found. So somebody took it. So I had to go back, and I was like, well, I got to do this show. I got to do this whole tour solo, opening for Effed Up, the second tour when I'm on Matador Records. And I had my buddy Rob Robinson like playing bongos while I, at one point, we like played a CD. We didn't have a sound person, so yeah, people were not having it all the time, you know. But and by the time we got to the Opera House, where it was your homecoming gig for your album. What album was that?
I think it was Chemistry and Common Life, right? Because I think you sing. You sing on David Comes to Life.
David Comes to Life.
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember I got to the Opera House, and I played the first song. And after the first song, somebody said, "You suck." And I was like, "Your mom." And then the crowd was like, "Ah," yeah. And they all left. And then like by the very end, it was literally like half the crowd was booing me. Half was cheering me on, like, "Don't give up." And I looked over to the side stage, and it was your bass player, Sandy, and others. And they're like, one more. And I was like, no, to the sound of a roar of a crowd. And then I played one more, and there was like, boom. It's fun.
One of our favorite tours ever. You were so good. And I tell bands all the time when they open for us, like, listen, Always and Kurt Vile both eclipsed us immensely in popularity shortly after the tour. So believe me, this is just, no matter how rough this tour gets, this might be an on-ramp.
Well, I saw you at FYF Fest in, LA.
Oh, LA one.
Yeah. LA. And you were awesome. And my album didn't come out yet, but you had heard it or something, or it just came out. I think it didn't come out, but you were.
No, we had promo copies because we were on Matador. So they gave us like a CDR.
It was awesome. And just to see. I don't know. So you were because I am actually a shy person, and I have like at the end of the day, I'm shy and have slight inferiority complex. So I always have to, once I get accepted, it's huge. And you were all like, you're definitely an intimidating band. And I was like, oh yeah, they're not going to like us. And then you were like, so friendly. And you're like, oh, I love that record. You took me on tour, and then it was only like then a little, yeah, you know, Dinosaur Jr. You were the first one to take me and invite me on tour. And then a little after that, Dinosaur Jr. was a fan. I was like, oh, here we go, man. I'm opening for all these punk bands. Effed Up, Dinosaur Jr., here we go. You know, I just want to be accepted by the punk bands, you know?
Well, that's like, that to me is like, and obviously I've not touched any sort of commercial heights, but to me, the greatest reward of doing this is like getting to meet Jay and getting to like be like friends with them. You know, this like unapproachable person, or to get to like meet your heroes and to be like your, have your heroes become peers and like be able to talk to them about music in a real direct, honest way.
Wow. And you know, that's interesting because it's true what all you said. And also we're the luckiest people in the world because somebody like Jay, no other reason in the world would we be able to talk to him unless we were related, unless we were a friend of a friend. And then would he talk to us? Like, so, and even then, like, it takes a minute to break the ice, but then we get to, be friends with our heroes. And, but we have a reason to be there. We play music, so we're backstage, you know, like other, you know, like it's natural for us to be there.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. And like, and I think with Jay, especially, he gets like a rough time because people are like, oh, he's so unapproachable. But he, I think Jay, if someone's down with Jay, in my experience, they're an awesome person. And that like, because he like goes to cities and like hangs out with the people that he actually gets along with. And so like when you meet someone who's with Jay, he really has just been like, yeah, no, this person's awesome. And they do cool stuff. And I like hanging out with them. And I find them interesting. And you're always like, yeah, this person is cool. Like it's a real bullshit detector.
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm going to actually play. I'm sitting in with them this weekend in New York because it's the anniversary shows of Where You Been.
Yeah.
Did you get invited to that?
Not this time. I'm no, Brian Schwartz no longer is my manager, so if I don't get invited,
okay.
But I just I sang with Dino last week at Primavera in Benidorm, and it's like the biggest thrill of my fucking life.
Where's Benidorm?
It's like a beach town, like tourist kind of British tourist center, just in Spain on the coast. And Primavera did like they took it over and had like a weekend of shows there, like Off played, wow. Bob Mould played, and then Dino played, and it was obviously like tons of fun, right? Like Blonde Redhead played, Deerhoof played the other day, Jesus and Mary Chain I think played the other day, Proto Martyr, and like Primavera I always find like one of the most fun festivals because you actually like it's such a cool mix of people every time.
Oh yeah, that was definitely our first festival around 2011 or that record Smoke Ring could have been 2012. That was when I was like, oh, wow, this, like, you know, I played a smaller stage, but it was by the water and, you know, just to like everybody be in Barcelona and cheering you on. You know, my friends Piss Jeans from Philly, punk band, were in the audience and like people were like, come on, Kurt, make me cry. You know, everybody called, like, I'm like, what, really? People are here to hear me like this? Like, I'm in Barcelona and, yeah, that was beautiful. And whatever.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you play that year, 2012?
Was that the year Neil Young played?
No.
No, I think we played the year after. Before. Yeah, we played that year before. It was awesome. We're like, because you know everyone chills in that big VIP area, and I'm with must have been Jay and Kevin Shields, and these girls come up to Kevin Shields and they're like, "Will you take a photo?" And he's like, oh yeah. And goes to stand with them. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? No, take a photo of us with Sonic Youth playing in the background. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And then takes a picture of them.
Oh, that's rules.
But it's like, that's what I think you and me bonded on, is we also had the same sort of like fan energy about a lot of shit, where we were like unabashedly excited about the stuff that we liked. And
that is true, actually. Now, yeah, you were always getting singles and talking about record. Yeah, that's what I always say. Like, ultimately, I'm just a fan. You know, I get obsessed with all kinds of music at once, but then I usually have one main obsession for a minute, and I get everything by that artist, and then they become part of my music, you know, eventually. But I say that now because I don't find myself playing guitar a lot lately, per se. But then next thing you know, I got a job and I'm forced to go out there and play, which is, thank God, you know, because if not, maybe I'll never play guitar again. But I'm a fan first, and it inspires me to play, and you know, then music comes out of that. You know?
I find it like affects the way I like music, like the business side and the anxiety side of being in a band makes it harder to appreciate music. And that's where I think the best show and for me, wrestling podcast kind of came in, where I could hear people talk in between. Cause I couldn't, as much as I love music, like music stressed the shit out of me after a certain point on the road, because like, that was my whole life, is like listening to music, playing music. And so those podcasts were like my escape.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tom, you know, yeah. Tom Sharpling is a good bridge too. We're both friends with him. In fact, I met Tom Sharpling through your tour. I kept hearing, no, I met him once because we opened for Big Star, and he thought we were making fun of him. Me and my bandmate, Adam Granofsky, from War on Drugs, but he was in the Violators, and we were obsessed with Tom, and we opened for Big Star. We heard he's there, and we bombarded him drunkenly with all kinds of, mainly quoting, honestly, Worcester, but whatever, yeah. You know, all his characters. And then we played Maxwell's together, and I was talking to somebody who was eating, and I was like, you know, heard Tom Sharpling's going to be here. And then Tom was literally right next to me, and he just started laughing. He had like chicken in his mouth.
Yeah. And you and me had bonded earlier in the tour, because the first day of tour, I went up to your merch table and you had a Kurt Vile, the band t-shirt, which melted my brain. Like, that was just like, oh my gosh. And you told me that was Rennie's idea right away. You're like,
yes. Yeah, Rennie. I got Rennie. I think that's the thing is, you could say that I'm like a little on the outskirts and a little aloof, but then I hear everything people are talking about, you know, all the punk rock and things. And then like, eventually I get hooked on something, you know. I've always been that way with punk rock. I think I'm just a music guy, but then it is true. Once you get on a tangent of punk, that said, I've never heard that Vile album, but that, yeah, he made a shirt, a Vile shirt, based on that Vile album cover, and I've never heard that.
One of the most infamous bands ever. Like, I would say G.G. Allin kind of level of infamy to hardcore kids. And I think, I know Gerard was at the one show they played, and I think Jay was at one of the shows they played, but they were like notorious for pulling a gun on the promoter or something. And then they stuck their album and everyone's windshield wiper in the parking lot, according to legend. People just threw them in the garbage. And that's why it's such a hard record to find.
Do you have one?
Eventually I got one. Eventually I did. Like, you threw a friend who actually reissued it. I traded a record for it from him. But, you know, once again, it was like Philadelphia stuff. And then I went up to you and we started talking about kind of this same way. Like, how'd you know about the file? Probably. And I said, Philadelphia. And then you said, oh yeah, Philly. And I went, Philly boy, Roy. And immediately you went into an impression. And I was at that point, being in the best show was still a little deeper cut than it is at this point. So we were like, I think, bonded to that immediately from there.
Oh man. Yeah, no, we did. And you were my end, cause he came and, to that show at Maxwell's, and then you know, I remember I gave him a signed copy of my, of whatever. I, you know what? Whatever. I'm getting it all a little mixed up because I didn't, I remember I was making the Childish Prodigy EP. Sorry. The Square Shells EP while I was on tour with you. I was like doing the artwork for that or getting somebody to help my band, Rob, to help. But anyway, it wasn't long after that tour that Tom invited me onto his show, and that was insane. And I've been on a few times since then. Yeah, what a hero. Like, what an outlet. Like, what a Tom's such a source for like good, but also like, yeah, you know, he'll make fun of anything, and he'll be so funny. And he's like, he runs the gamut, or he's self-deprecating on himself, and then he's totally, you know, rightly cocky about something, you know. It's just encouraging to people like us somehow. I don't know what it is, man, but I think we're just East Coasters. Sure, you're up there in Canada, but it's not that far.
Well, he was up here. I know now he hates it. Like, I feel bad because, like, Tom and I really drifted apart, I think, after he was up here for What We Do in the Shadows. Because I think he was a real hatred for Canada now, and I feel like I'm involved in that.
Oh, you were involved in that?
Not at all, but I just feel like that was weirdly at a point when we kind of started drifting a little bit. But, you know, like, he is without a doubt one of the biggest influences on me, and that Best Show is like one of the greatest things ever. Those Sharpling Worcester calls they got me through tours. There were tours where I was like so fucking miserable before I discovered weed, and it was just like, my God. But there were just these calls that kind of kept me going, and the mystery of them and everything, right? Yep. Like, you know, and that might also be why I had that weird thing with John Cougar Mellencamp, because there's those Glass House's Worst Artist of the Year calls. Do you remember that call where it's Ace John Benjamin is there too?
No.
Oh
no.
My gosh. It's like Worcester calls in, and he's in who's the guy who does Uptown Girl again?
Billy Joel.
Billy Joel. He's in a Billy Joel cover band. And then Ace John Benjamin calls over and he's in a John Cougar Mellencamp cover band. Yeah, I'll find it. I'll send it to you. I think I still got your number from back then.
Okay. Pass on. Yeah, it's the same one.
What's the deal with the Foibles split from 1998? You would have been like 17 years old.
Okay, there is one release that is not me. That's a Kurt Vile. So maybe you're talking about that. I didn't know there was a split. But is it Kurt Vile and the
Heady somethings? They weirdly were on a punk label from out west. But they were like Kurt Vile and the Nest of Saws. That's it. Sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, no, that's not me.
That's wild.
And luckily, they didn't pursue that name.
Yeah, but this is a real name, no gimmick situation with you. Right, because I'm sure.
Yeah, real name, no gimmicks. That person could also be a Kurt Vile. Who knows? But I love, that's my favorite. The clever people who are like, oh yeah, like think that I'm being clever. But they're being clever. Like they think they're clever for bringing up that it's a play on Kurt Vile, the German composer. But that's them being stuffy, thinking they're clever because they're wrong, and it's my name.
Yeah. I thought I was being clever because there was a connection between you and the Rhythm Pigs through that 7-inch. And I was like, how'd you get a record out at 17 years old? And it was blowing my mind. But
oh, man,
I feel very reaffirmed.
I should dig that up. I should get one of those.
I know it's hard to find. It's not for sale. Imagine how many times that's sold to some like your fan thinking they got like the early first 7-inch, like the Billy Joe Armstrong 7-inch he did as an 8-year-old type thing.
Oh, man.
But that's still crazy that you did a record with a guy who was in that band, Oscar, that was on Epitaph. They were on Epitaph in like 99, 2000.
Well, it's just a split.
It's a split, but still, it's like, that's like an Epifat connection. And here you are getting into NoFX early on. I know, obviously, you didn't stick around too much in that genre, but the Kurt Vile Epifat connection is real.
Yeah, dude. Some of the, there was a cluster of bands I liked that probably everybody liked at this time when I was into new school punk for a minute. It was like NOFX, Pennywise, Face to Face, Rancid, probably in reverse order. Like I got into Rancid and NOFX, you know. I still like certain NOFX songs. I still like from like The Longest Line, or in my head at least. I haven't heard them lately, but they get, you know, then there's that band Propagandhi. They sound exactly like NOFX. That's crazy now to hear the song Fuck Religion.
Yeah.
When he's talking about the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Like I think about, my mind goes there immediately. They were singing about it back then. Yeah. But
that's Canada's greatest band, dude. Like obviously.
Are they Canada?
Yeah, dude. Winnipeg.
Oh, killer.
Hardcore Kids too from Winnipeg. Like there's some connection to the Sadies. Like Guilt Parade. They were really inspired by Guilt Parade, which was Sean's band before he did the Sadies. Before, and Flight Camp was another huge band for those guys out in Propagandhi. And then Propagandhi, like one of the greatest, like you're saying, I learned about Noam Chomsky. I learned about Howard Zinn. I learned about Maya Angelou. I learned about all this shit that I did not learn about in school through these records, like Propagandhi records and these sort of samples they would have or books they would list in their liner notes. And it was
calling it out then. Calling it out then.
Yeah, man. It was like, that's the thing that's fascinating about this kind of music, because it is, at one time, it's like sort of the sophomoric snowboarder frat party jock kind of thing. But then at the other time, it's also like a gateway to like Riot Girl, and it's two steps removed from that whole world, and it's two steps removed from Forced Exposure and all this sort of thing. Like NOFX. Like you can make that jump in two moves.
Yeah. I'm excited to listen to Discharge and think about my girl Jenny, though. We love each other forever. I've been meaning to call her. She also reached out to me when my bandmate Rob passed away, so which was really sweet. Because actually, I know her through my bandmate Rob, and we toured together multiple times with Black Bananas, and she's just a sweetheart. And then her voice. You know, when I sing sometimes with a snarl, and it's all about, it's like, I just want to be Jenny. I just want to be Jennifer Harima, you know?
Yeah. Royal Trux was like the realest band ever. And in a way that like the authenticity is kind of like obviously dangerous for the parties involved. Like there was no, I think especially at that time, there's a lot of people kind of playing at that. And then they were like unapproachably cool, but also like, it was like a real danger to the coolness, to everything about that band.
Yeah, man. Uno dos tres, it's a snap. Man, she cuts through. She cuts through. I like, that's the main thing I look for in a singer is like, do they cut through? Yeah. Like her voice literally cuts through, but it also like cuts into my brain and my heart.
Well, and that's the thing is when you hear it, there's like, you can tell there's something about it that's like, that's punk. Like there's an energy that's through all this stuff. And I would even like, you hear it in The Dead Milkman the first time you hear, If You Love Somebody, Set Them on Fire or something. You know, like you hear this thing that, like you're saying, it cuts through in a way that you hear all this stuff. And then years later, you find out that all these people were kind of going to Minor Threat shows and we're all Bad Brains fans and we're all out coming at this from the same place, or there's part of this lineage.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
You know, like where would, do you ever think like where you would be if you didn't kind of have this sort of outsider? I know you're saying it's like an outsider path, but like this path through punk, like, do you ever think about like, where would you have found entry or where would you have found yourself?
Yeah. I mean, in the sort of DIY, do your like, I definitely did the DIY thing more than others, to get noticed. I mean, I was doing it anyway, but like, or my buddy Richie told me, even when I put it out on Gulcher, he's like, you're sending your music to these bigger labels or medium-sized label. And he said it in a funny way. He's like, oh, because they're not going to be like, hey, why don't I put out this record of this person no one's ever heard of? Or I could put out this record and know it's going to do all right. Like you get those people like Matador, et cetera. They kind of saw that I was doing it anyway. You know, you kind of, and that I guess that's a punk attitude, but it was also necessity. You know, I just had, but that's a mentality. You know, that's not necessarily a sound. But at times, you know, I could be influenced through sound as well, you know, but I had the sensitive acoustic thing, and I was always a pretty great finger picker. So I can't help that. You know, I can't help it if I'm a great acoustic finger picker. I'm also influenced by punk. No, but yeah. And then, you know, then there you got people like X. I just played a show with John Doe and Terry Allen, and obviously they were incredible players from the beginning. But you don't always associate that with. Sorry to ramble. I was just thinking about my folky acoustic guitar, which isn't necessarily punk, you know. But
I don't know.
Just influence.
I think it is, right. Like I think like. Not to cut you off, but right up to, I know Billy Bragg's not on acoustic, but like you look at the Desperate Bicycles and Advice on Arrest, which to me is the greatest punk song I've ever written. And it's on acoustic guitar. And it's, there's and those Gizmo songs, not to beat that horse again, but I feel like they're such an underrated band, but Velvet Underground too. Stooges have the acoustic guitar on some stuff. And it's just,
oh yeah. Gimme Danger, the best.
Yes.
And I think my favorite punk song of all time, if I was to pick one, is also the most, it's also beautiful, and it's also just gut, like it's just beautiful. And that's Dirt, you know, Dirt by the Stooges off of Raw Power. And it's like, you know, it's minor melody, you know, the chorus is like, do you feel it when you touch me? And it's just those, I don't know, what is it? E minor to C to G, something like that. And it's just, and then he hits the wah, and it just gets so beautiful and intense. And so, yeah, you know, and Give Me Danger, that beautiful acoustic, it's like jangly, and again, it's minor. Yeah.
I love thinking about that. The Stooges are kind of wrapping up, and they finish in LA, and they've got that run of the whiskey where they're playing two shows a day. And they're just, you know, by all accounts, Iggy's dying on stage every day. And then the Stooges break up there, and Bowie runs in and rescues Iggy and kind of leaves the rest of the dudes there. And it's kind of like the Stooges are like decomposing as a band. And out of that comes LA punk, like comes X, comes all these bands, like as the next wave. But like you needed the Stooges to kind of die there to kind of like be that permission for that next wave.
Yeah. Well, when, yeah, exactly. When was he dying on stage? Are you saying like the making of Funhouse or like after
like they went out to LA, kind of like, what is it? There's like a bunch of live records from the whiskey where the audience is like throwing cigarettes at him and booing him. And Keith Morris told me a story, but when he went there, he like dumped a thing of water on himself and then grabbed the mic and got electrocuted and just passed out on the stage. And the roadies came in and broke everything down. And then last thing they carried off was Iggy, you know,
wow.
Like he's like destroying himself like twice a day for people. But that's like, that's the inspiration for all these kids that would wind up being that first wave of LA punk, right? Like, yeah, like Stooges 100%. Where if I was like, what would it have been like to see them back then, like to have no reference point, and there's a guy standing on the crowd covering himself in peanut butter?
Yeah, but do you know when and where Funhouse was recorded exactly? Like, what, when was that?
70. I feel like Jay would be really pissed at both of us right now.
Well, more you.
Well, he knows that I'm more the hardcore guy. he trusts your sense of music overall, I think, more than mine. He hasn't asked me to produce any records.
No, well, I'm more curious in the moment, like getting specific.
Yeah, I'll figure it out. We'll come back on one day, you, me, and Jay, and we'll hash this all out.
All right.
It'll be a fun conversation with him. Speaking of Jay, Kyle Spence, you know, one of the great drummers, hardcore kid as well.
I was going to say that earlier, like when we're talking about Jay, we grab Jay's posse when we can, you know. Yeah, we needed a new drummer, and I got Kyle Spence. The first time I saw Kyle Spence was when he was flown into Canada because Murph couldn't get in, and he It was the end of the tour I was on with Dinosaur Jr., the first one back in 2010. And he killed it. And he's from Harvey Milk, you know that band?
Oh yeah, and he also played in Fiddlehead. And I found out today he played in a band called A Finger, not to be confused, I guess, with the other many fingers from that part of America. But that I have on a 7-inch compilation. And I had no idea he was in that band till today. But yeah, definitely deep roots. I love Harvey Milk, though. What a underrated band.
Yeah, I love them too. I was listening to one of their CDs at the end of the final Violators tour before the pandemic hit, and it was hitting me hard. I wish I had I remembered it, but I'm definitely proud that Kyle is from there. You know, he played in Dino, and then I basically took Dinosaur Jr.'s bench warmer drummer away so that they had no other options and that they had to just, you know, we all wanted anyway, but I took Kyle out of the equation. We needed him. And he's been in the band since 2014. And yeah, he gets better all the time. We've been on the road a lot this last 2 years, and now he's crazy good. I mean, he's always been good, but we're as a live entity, and he's also a great engineer. So we got, you know, when we work together, we can all sort of record. We can record it at the same time, but our live shows have gotten off the chain thanks to Kyle.
Yeah, I think he's unbelievable. I haven't seen him obviously lately, but I got it. Next time he comes through Toronto, I will be there because
yeah, I'll make sure you come.
One of my favorite peeps. And once again, a testament, like you're saying, like they're a band, like everyone in Dino, from crew to the people in the band, is super chill. And
yeah, totally.
Has good temperament and stuff like that, and a good vibe.
Yeah, no, lately we've been working with John Maloney. You know John Maloney?
Love John.
Yeah, he's
favorites.
He's been working with us lately, and it's just like, well, because my buddy Adam Langelotti is the most recent member of the band, and he's Western Mass. I've known him forever, but he works with Dino and is old friends with John. But so, like, between, yeah, it feels more like family all the time. I have this extended Massachusetts family, sort of, and it's really nice. And I love that.
Because I also feel, not to get heavy and weird, but like I feel that same way about the Sadies too.
Yeah.
That it's like part of like an extended family, and they're the people that, you know, obviously Dallas meant so much to everyone here, but like meeting, I was trying to put together the sequence of events. If you had done that tour with them first or the tour with us first.
Actually, it's interesting you bring it up, because I will tell you that I think we didn't know each other that well during that tour, but Dallas basically told me he accepted me on that tour because I had just toured with Effed Up, and he was interested in that, and he wanted to play with you. He didn't know you yet.
Yeah.
And he was listening to Chemistry of Common Life in his headphones all the time, laying in the back seat. And he was wanting to play with you. And that was literally a big reason why he agreed. Because I rode in their van. I mean, they hadn't done that. And I wasn't thinking about it much. I was like, sure. But then you obviously have to show up and ride in a van with a bunch of strangers. And I'm shy at first. And they're shy at first in their way. So we didn't talk for the first day.
Well, can you tell what happened? Where they? Because also when you ride with the Sadies, you gotta go to a Sadies party. And didn't they give you something before the ride?
Well, eventually I had a weed cookie for sure. And I was riding with, for a minute, I was in the front seat with Travis, who I saw him play and I knew he was amazing. And he's so tall and he had those aviator shades on and drive. And he drives this 15 passenger van with a trailer hitch, going under the speed limit or exactly the speed limit. And then I was like, oh, no big deal. This cookie was delicious, you know. And then like way longer later, I was like, dude, I think I'm – and then Travis basically just said, he said, I am You know, like meaning like, dude, I know what you're about to say. We were just on the moon, man. We're on the moon. It was the best.
Yeah, and still like an unbelievable band. Like rest in peace to Dallas, and there's a void that will never be filled in music without him.
Yeah,
But
you know, it's criminal, and it's like, but that's heavy, and you know, that's beautiful. What when it everybody knows, you know, everybody knows that that's such a blow, and yeah. We're just so lucky that we've seen them, best live band of all time, and they're still going. And everybody was a little happy for them, but nervous about that. And they're carrying the torch, and yeah, they're brothers to me. And you know, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I got to write a song. I'm so glad I got to put those words in a song. They sent me an instrumental, track that came out on Northern Passages. I didn't know what the words were going to be, but I was up in New York, and I played some Vice related thing, and I was in New York working on different various things, and I passed out with my f family like kind of late, and I woke up, and the lyrics came to me and like in my dreams or whatever, and I wrote it down on the back of a book, and it's like playing guitar with your brother, like plant one foot in front of the other. It's easy like walking, you know. It's just singing about, like, I didn't know what it's going to be, you know. But then you're like, it's so essential that you got to put those two brothers in there playing guitar together. They literally could play each other's guitar with that was one of their tricks, with their left hand. They play the other's fret. The crowd goes wild. And so we have that connection, that Toronto connection of having toured together with both those bands multiple times. And so yeah, I'm stoked that I got to put that in the song, because who knew that somebody had to put that in a song, you know?
yeah, like it really, hearing you do stuff with them afterwards meant a lot. Just seeing that, because you were like one of the first people that kind of they did stuff with, and just knowing that it was going to carry on, like Dallas would have wanted. Like, you know that Dallas would have wanted this to be, because they're too good. Like, you know, obviously with Dallas, it was like that the two guitar thing is obviously the trick that everyone remembers. But it's funny, I was showing my kids YouTube videos of it this week. Like, just being like, you see this? Like, look how amazing that is, because they're learning how to play guitar now, and just being like, this is what growing up in music and punk music too. Like, both those guys were like part of the Stalag version of the scene from 80s Toronto here, with a bunch of fucking goofs,
Wow.
and coming out of that world as well and stuff. So yeah, it's funny, because then I got to, I guess I met Dallas after you had toured with them. Because I remember talking to you about Dallas, I guess when we saw each other again. And then you played that festival in Toronto with them too, like a big outdoor thing at Fort York.
Yeah, that was when we reunited.
Yeah.
Well, at least Travis. I hadn't seen Travis, and that was amazing. Yeah, it's true.
Not to go from sore point to sore point, but you played in the Swirlies as well, right? For a hot minute.
Well, okay. I was when I moved to Boston in like 2001, 2002. I was there in 2000. It turned into 2001. I was a fan of my bandmate Rob Laxo's, my late bandmate Rob Laxo's band, the Wicked Farleys, and then we got into the Swirlies too. And he was in. He went to Emerson in like the recording. He was in the he had, it was like a recording audio major, and he early on when I got there, I had played with the Wicked Farleys a couple times, and then early on we went and saw a movie one night and drank some beers, and then we went back to his dorm room, and I recorded some jams on his keyboard that he would through some of his crazy noise rig that he had, and basically that ended up on the Swirlies' Cats of the Wild Forever 2 or something. Cats of the Wild 2, which that came out around the time I moved back to Philly in 2003. It's a later Swirlies record, and Rob Laxo is on that record. And so technically I am too, but he was more a conventional member of the band. But yeah, the Swirlies are the best. They're like the shoegaze punk thing, And then the Jaguar guitar, which I copied, you know, which my bandmate Rob Laxo copied first, and like the a certain synthesizer that I won't even say by name is their secret weapon, because I got that too. And so that's my connection to the Swirlers, and we've toured together, but I'm on a sort of like hidden track at the end of Cats of the Wild too. I've listened to that a lot recently, because it's also on, I think it's on my bandmate Rob's audio project. His thesis. He's got like a thesis. He put out the CD at the end, and I listened to it. Those hooks are super catchy, man. I gotta put it like today with electronic music and pop, whatever. I'm gonna sample that and turn it into a song again and involve them, I guess.
That's awesome. Not to go back to something kind of trivial, but like, yeah, a really underrated band, the Swirlies, and a band that it feels like kind of in the shoegaze revival is getting like another look by people.
Yeah, I think they are definitely always. I saw them posting Chimp Rock Forever, and I was like, that's cool and all, but you know, those are my brothers, and you never play with them, only me. But like, no, I actually really like Always a lot. I'm going to play some shows with them soon, but I did see that they were calling out the Swirlies, and I was like, that's awesome. But yeah.
They came out of the fucked up opening for Boot Camp with
I know.
Epic Reaction. So there you go. You got that in common.
I know. I heard you mention that, and I'm about to play with them sometime next year, and we're definitely playing before them. They're you can't deny their catchy earworm. I love them. Honestly, it is a funny story. I was mixing Waking on a Pretty Days with John Aniello. Did you work with John Aniello ever?
No, but I've hung out with John at the Dino Summer Camp.
Right.
Great guy.
But I heard he was sent some Always demos, stuff they recorded for themselves. At the time, I remember them being more folky in my mind, but it was super catchy. And it was awesome. He's like, yeah, I'm going to mix this. And I was like, it sounds done. And he's like, shut up. You know, like my point is they had it from the beginning. You know? They had it from the beginning. But anyway, yeah, to jump around, the Swirlies, they spent their wild and youthful days in the glittering world of the salons as a masterpiece. The album before that, is also awesome.
But the one on Tang?
I love this
one. On Tang.
They're both on Tang.
The first tape, which I did not learn till today, that they put out was a split with Drop Dead.
I know. And over the pandemic, somebody drew that cassette, or painted it, I should say. It's a really good painting. And I bought that from this
artist.
Are you
kidding me?
And I've been meaning to listen to that.
I got to see that painting.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
I want
to
see a photo of that.
Cool
that's
painting.
Wild. That's awesome. That's so weird, because like, I had no idea that tape even existed till today, but that's awesome that someone painted it.
Are you a fan of Drop Dead?
Love them.
Cool. Love
them. There's a great Drop Dead mini Riot video from Toronto from a show back in the day where the singer talks down like a guy with a knife that's pulled a knife on him. It's like it was an intense Toronto show. At our Stalag 13, who's Emma?
What?
We had a Stalag 13 kind of vibe here with Who's Emma was our Stalag 13 type venue.
Who's Emma?
Who's Emma?
Like a question?
Yeah. Like Emma, I guess Emma Goldman lived in Kensington Market, that part of Toronto. And there was this like punk venue, you know, like that's the thing about these venues. You just, anyone could play there. I got to play that stage way before I should have been playing on stage with different bands. And then sometimes cool, great bands would come through, like Drop Dead.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was definitely like, yeah, it was a great time. And Kurt, this has been a great time, buddy. And like, you and me, we gotta stay in touch. It feels like it feels like not a day's gone by. You look just as young as you did back then, buddy.
Wow, you look great. You look great. You
lying.
Look younger.
Well, that's if you look like shit from the beginning. There's nowhere to go but up, right? Like,
well, that I mean, no, but you look great, and that's not what I meant. But I also me, I don't. I quit drinking back in 2019, so that might have saved me a little bit. But I'm glad that I'm very complimented, and I do miss you. I miss hanging, and I you know, Toronto for sure. Let's hang. I see Sandy, though. I've seen Sandy a fair amount.
We were all going to come out to the last show, but then I had sick kids. So, you know.
That's what it was.
Three kids is, you know what it's like with multiple kids. It's just like two Petri dishes coming home every day.
How old are they?
I have a 14-year-old, an 11-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And my 14-year-old's 6'4".
Wow. Yeah, I have a 13-year-old, and she's the first one. You know, I was about, basically after I toured with y'all, it wasn't long before my first daughter was born. And now she's 13, so you know what that does to our timeline. Yes. And yeah, the other one, the younger one, is 11.
Did you want to have like a lot? Because you grew up in a house with like tons of siblings. Did you want to have tons of kids, or were you like deliberately like, let's have less than 9 or 10?
Yeah, definitely less than 10 would be good. but yeah, I'm one of 10. But yeah, two. We would like another one. I don't know if that'll happen, but two is awesome.
Two fundamentally broke me. Like, it broke me so bad as a human.
Well, now we're a gang, you know. Now that they can walk, we went all over the world when we had to carry them, you know. But still, now we're a gang, so it's really fun.
I wish my 14-year-old tries to kill me on a daily basis. He does jiu-jitsu, and I think I've become like a tackling dummy. And
oh man, well, I got two lovely ladies, so nobody's tackling me lately anyway.
Well, they also, I revealed to me yesterday, my eldest has not talked to me about this type of music, but his friend came over and said that he's really into indie rock, and they said Kurt Vile and Mac DeMarco, so I'm going to get cool points, even if he won't admit it to me.
Oh, wow. Tell him I said what's up.
I will, buddy. Well, you pass on my regards to the family, and anytime you want to come on here by yourself, with Jay, with anybody, you know you're always welcome.
Oh, that'd be super fun. Yeah, with Jay.
Thank you, Kurt, for coming on the show. And Kurt will be back for a part two at some point in the future. In the meantime, check out Back to Moon Beach. And also, check out all the great Sadie's records as well. We got talking about that, and I went out and listened to some Sadie's stuff afterwards. And my gosh, Kurt is right when he says they're one of the greatest bands of all time. And so is Kurt. Kurt's amazing as well. One of the greatest songwriters. One of my favorite songwriters. You know, all his records, even the ones I didn't admit at first that I love. You know, I love them all. Fantastic. All right. Coming up on the next episode of Turned Out a Punk, you got a Christmas present under the tree. I guess a holiday present if you do not celebrate Christmas, or just if you just got a present. Because coming up on the next episode for an awesome conversation, the legend from the band Murphy's Law, Uncle Jimmy, as he says he wants to be called from now on, will be on the show. And this is an awesome conversation. It goes a lot of cool places, a lot of interesting places, some heavy places too. And it's all waiting for you on the next episode of this show right here. All right, that is it for this week, or this one. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights, and stop hate and violence towards people of different sexual orientations, different races, different religions, different faiths, because this isn't politics. This is just basic human rights shit. People deserve to live free from hate and violence. So if there's organizations in your world that are making or trying to affect positive change in an area that you believe change needs to happen in, get involved. Donate your time. If you can afford it, donate money. I'm sure they need it, because it gets better when you make it better. Like punk. Speaking of punk, start a band. Start a fanzine, start a podcast, start a record label, do anything, get involved, because this gets better when more people get involved. Make someone a mixtape. That's very outmoded. You have to buy them a Walkman, and be a, anyway, scratch that idea. I guess make them a playlist. Make someone a playlist. And spread the word about this thing. Speaking of spreading the word about things, spread the word about signing your organ donor card. Because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. And they can perform literal miracles. I've seen it happen. Try meditating. I try it and it works for me. I need to remember to do it more often. I know a lot of people are really good at it. And for me, it didn't, I don't know, there's no particular discipline or anything like that. I use one of the apps and yeah, it works for me. So maybe it will work for you. Anyway, thank you for listening and I will see you on the next episode.